So I'm moving house next week, almost. It's nearly finished.
You had a house built?
Yes. Well, of course, sort of. I went to a place where they're building houses, and there was one there that I liked, so we bought it. And they finished making it because I could look at the picture and go, house. And it'll be finished next week. So now I have to move house yet again.
Right, that's right. You moved once, and then you moved into this apartment to kind of stage the next thing. And and now it's the time is – in fact, by the time this goes out, you'll probably have moved. And you'll be in Packet Pusher's palatial UK headquarters.
That's right. Well, palatial? You've seen the photo.
Okay, it's a small office stuck on the side of the house. But, you know, it is an office.
It is, and it'll be dedicated, and it has a fire-rated door to the house, even less interaction with humans than I do now.
So what you're saying is, when the house is on fire and burning down, you'll be able to stay in the office safe and be able to continue recording and doing what you do.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it. New space. Only problem is I've got to dampen it. I think it's very active. The audio is going to be a bit of a problem. Might have to hang some absorbent foam or something in it.
That's actually a project left for my office is the foam. I actually have bought foam and need to hang it. And because I don't want to use an adhesive to attach it to the wall, but I do need to reduce some of the echo in this room. I have a very loud room in the sense that a lot of hard surfaces and some foam should definitely help with that.
Yeah, I've been thinking about hanging a picture rail near to the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And then you can hang everything on picture hooks. Do you know, like in the old Victorian homes, they have what they call a picture rail? It's about a foot down from the ceiling, and it's actually got it's a piece of architraving that has actually got a hook on the top. And you can put these little metal hooks onto it and then some wire to suspend anything off it.
Yeah, I get it. Makes sense. Yeah.
Well, in the old days, the plaster that went onto the bricks never actually attached very strongly to the bricks.
Mm-hmm.
So most English houses are red brick underneath and then rendered with a plaster. And so if you try to put hooks into those, like nails or screws, you know what happens. Plaster just comes straight off.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
So you put in an architrave picture rail around the top, and then you hang everything off it. And then, of course, you can move everything around as you see fit, which is kind of nice.
So it occurs to me that as we're recording this, the Big Apple event is coming up next week. Do you care?
I do. Well, a little. I'm looking forward to it because the next generation of Mac's operating system, you know, I'm a big Mac user, as are you now.
And, yes, I am.
So I'm looking forward to the new operating system, which promises to sort of go a bit faster and get some more stuffs in there. That'll be good. I'm not too worried about everything else. I'm not going to get a new phone. I've got my iPhone 6. I have a once every 2 year purchasing policy on phones. And so my wife's turn this year, and then my daughter will then get her cast off. There's much anticipation in certain quarters of the house, but not with me as such. You?
Yeah, definitely getting a new phone. Well, I say definitely. I mean, that has been the plan for a while now. I have a 4S, so I'm on the 2 year cycle. And when I got my 4S,
it was old. 4S is a bit older than that. There's a 5, 5S, 6.
That's right. So I am going back in time a ways. Yeah. My 4S is definitely has screen poverty. It's a beautiful little Retina screen, but it is a little screen. Mm. And so I like to do things on my phone like read Feedly and catch up on the news in the morning. Yep. And it's like I'm just looking at this. The older I get, the more my eyes go, man, this little screen kind of blows. Mm. And so a bigger screen will be good. And I'm still undecided as to the big one or the lesser big one, or should I say the big one or the huge one,
the six is a good size, I find. Mm. I have tried the bigger one, but I have an iPad. I have a full-size iPad for my bigger stuff. So if I'm going to read feeds and things like that, I pull my iPad out. But then my eyes are going as I get old because I'm getting decrepit. So don't laugh.
We both just told all of our listeners that we're getting old.
Of course we are.
That's awesome. Mm. That's awesome.
So I'm looking forward. There's some rumors of a 12-inch iPad. I'm not sure I'm going to go for that, but I don't need a new iPad. They don't tend to wear out as such. So I'm not sure. It's really just new operating system. I'm sure iOS 9 is going to be interesting. But on the iPad, the new operating system means having two screens. I downloaded a couple of things this week, actually, might be to diverge into very non-networking stuff. We'll see if the audience likes us talking about non-networking. But there's a new app for my iPad called LiquiText.
LiquiText, okay.
And the things it does, it's really, I'm not going to try and remotely even verbalize what it does, but this app is the duck's guts for reading stuff. LiquiText. It's free. You link it to various things, and then you go and, so in my case, I'm downloading documents from Dropbox. So I download them, save them into a folder for Dropbox for read. and then I pick up documents that I white papers or research papers and read them on there. It allows you to do lots and lots of really interesting ways to rethink the way you read and take quotes and stuff like that out of it.
That might be interesting. I might look at that. My current process is my Kindle. So I have a Kindle Voyage that I picked up recently, which is the highest end Kindle you can get. It is a beautiful device. I love the thing. And my process is I have an app called Wunderlist that I use on my desktop and on all of my devices. And I will put a note in there for anything it is that I want to read. And then when I get a minute, I'll download it and ship it to the Kindle and have the Kindle reformat it. And then I just focus on my reading within the Kindle. Mm-hmm. And it's been glorious. I've been consuming a ton of data that way lately since I got the Kindle. It's changed the way I consume information. Mm. I've been doing very well with it.
Mm. I find the iPad both a boon because I can have all of my ebooks on there and a curse because my RSS reader's on there. And so I can easily, if I get distracted in any way, I'll flop off into something else, you know, like.
That's exactly the problem I had with, I had an iPad mini and would do the same thing. I'd read stuff, but then be like, ooh, shiny. And I'd go over to whatever the shiny was, yep. Twitter or whatever. It was very, very distracting. The Kindle helps me retain focus. I can sit in bed with a thing and read it. The charge lasts forever. It's very portable on a plane. Mm. And I'm just finding that device, because it has more or less distraction free, means I'm doing much better with getting information through the system. Mm. So it's good.
Yep.
Hey, you're checking your phone number too, aren't you?
I'm ditching my phone number, yeah. I've had the same phone number since I arrived in the UK when we migrated from Australia to the UK. So that's 10 years now. And what's happened is I just get turned, it's just ordinary phone calls, and she's recruiters and various people I've done business with over the years. And it's just gotten to the point where anybody who calls me on my phone makes me want to just reach out and slap them around the head. If only there was a button for that on my phone. You know, slap round head. Just press that. That'd be good, wouldn't it? Like, people would probably do that to me. That wouldn't be so good.
And so the idea is just to make a clean break because, in effect, with us working on packet pushers full time, a lot of the calls that you'd be getting aren't business engagements that you're actually going to engage in.
Mm-hmm. The vast majority of calls that I get are just recruiters going, oh, we want somebody. And I'm getting like, you know, I'm not interested in a new job. I've just, you know, set up my own company, so I don't need a new job. Packet pushers, right? So, right. But it's just endless. It's like every day there's a call from a recruiter sort of, you know, and some days you think they're just going to burst into tears, which would be nice. I'd like to hear them suffer a bit more. That really would be nice, actually. And I'm kind of done. I just don't want to get that anymore. And I keep saying to them, remove me from your database. And but there's hundreds of the little buggers. And they've all got my personal information and my mobile number. So despite 5 years of really solid effort not to. So I'm just going to walk away from it and start again. I was thinking about, is that so unusual? And then I realized, actually, if you work in a corporate company and your phone comes from big company X, when you quit, you lose it, right?
Sure,
so in
yeah.
the past, I actually, probably the longest I've ever owned a mobile phone is because I've been freelancing for 10 years. I've always kept the same phone.
Yeah, the last phone I got, my 4S, in fact, I was employed by another company and they gave me the option. You can get your own phone and expense it, or we'll get you a phone and just pay for everything. And I chose, just so that I wouldn't lose the number, to get my own phone and expense it.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I've had the same number now for, 3 years or so, something like that.
Yeah.
And that's been good because I've been able to use that number for our business, and that's been handy because now I get calls from, you know, random people going, we have a great opportunity for your business. And they come
the
through like that.
While we wait to get an operator to talk to you because you've got nothing better to do than listen to a recording.
And so I don't answer it anymore if it doesn't come up on my contact list. I've learned I used to pick it up because it's like, oh, it'll be, you know, someone, and unless it's coming from San Francisco or the Valley, if it's not my contact list, I just don't pick it up anymore. I don't get too many of them, but
I'll tell you one big problem I'm facing is that my phone number has become linked to a certain number of accounts like Google and Twitter and certain.
Oh, yes.
Right. So if you want to change your password, they send a text message or you have to type in a number or something like that. So it's actually going to be quite painful disengaging that in that sense. And I'm looking forward to that part, actually. But, you know, whatever.
So we have a new website that we've been making some progress on.
Yep.
We're at a point now where we've completely cut over and we're experimenting with some of the new features. And we've actually got a little bit of a lull where we're settling down and just kind of letting the dust settle and seeing where things go. We're not getting too many complaints from old stuff or broken links. But if those happen, again, let us know. I did see a tweet yesterday of someone saying, oh, this tweet came through and the link was busted and here's the correct link. And that was actually our old site, which was still kicking around at our old provider, yes. Even though the DNS is no longer pointed to it, with a Tweetly plugin in the background that recycles old content, spits it out there. So I went in yesterday, it's like, oh, we forgot about that.
Yep.
Shut it down and, you know, and all that stuff. And we still got more work to do on the new site, but by and large, it's there.
Yeah. During the cutover, we had a mistake with the feed. And if you were subscribed to the weekly show, which is this recording, then you may have noticed that you suddenly got a lot of other podcast stuck in there. Now, because of the way iTunes works, the only way to solve that overload of content, if you don't want to go back to just the weekly shows, is you'll have to delete the feed and then resubscribe in iTunes. The way that iTunes works is it reads the configuration. There was an error in the configuration, and it's loaded into your client, and it's nothing we can fix at the server end. Yay for iTunes.
That, again, several of you, actually more of you than some, a few of you were upset. A few were like, you guys are killing me. You went to the new site. I used to get the weekly show. Now we're getting all your stuff. I don't want it all. I hate you so much.
Yeah, you and sold out.
A little bit of that.
You sold out.
Yeah.
It was a couple of those.
But more of you, far more of you said, you guys have all this other content. I had no idea there were all these other Packet Pusher shows, and this stuff's really great. And you're like, don't want to change.
Yeah.
So if you're in that boat and you happen to be getting all the content, I mean, maybe you just want to go onto iTunes, search for Packet Pushers, and find the full feed or the fat pipe, whatever it's called. There is one of the feeds in there. We'll give you every show that we publish.
There's a lot of them.
And you can get the weekly show and Priority Queue and Network Break and Data Knots. All of that stuff is going to come down in one feed if that's what you want, or subscribe to the ones that you prefer individually.
And we're going to be doing some surveys in the near future. We've decided that part of the challenge of being who we are is that we sort of lose some touch with what's actually happening in the real world. And what we'd like to do is start finding new ways of sharing information with the community about trends and bigger picture things. And so we're going to start looking at running the odd survey. Now, they'll be published, probably start with Google Docs, I think. And if they're a success, we'll get into a more commercial platform and make them slicker and sexier. But for now, you're going to see us talking a little bit about surveys where we ask questions like, you know, how complex is your data center, or are you really going to do something? One we're looking at the moment is the data center sanity check, which is going to ask you the questions that no one else would ask you.
The whole idea here is you guys that listen to the show are practitioners. You actually do stuff. So whereas an analyst firm can do a survey, but it's kind of like, where is their data coming from? Who are answering these questions? And a lot of it's more financially related. We're looking more from the people in the trenches who actually do stuff. What's going on in your world? What are the trends that you guys are seeing? You know, are you actually moving to cloud? And what does that mean? Is anyone having that conversation, you know, again, from that real world perspective. We're not analysts, but we are if you listen to the show. And again, it's all from that perspective of the end user, not CIOs and people drawing things on whiteboards who have really little touch with reality. So surveys, yes,
surveys.
You will see more of them.
So, you know, and if you don't like surveys, just don't answer them. We won't be upset. Well, I'll cry a little. I'll get little tears in the corners of my eyes.
Well, obviously, we're going to want you to answer surveys. So what we're not going to do is have 50 question surveys. We'll try to keep it to, like, you know, 5 questions, 10 questions.
Yeah.
Short, to the point, and something funny in there to, you know, some Monty Python references or some such.
Yeah, my favorite one at the moment is, you're in a cafe in Bromley. There's a lot of Vikings around. What will you eat? Spam, 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 baked beans and spam. So we're trying to be.
So we will try to do our surveys Packet Pusher style, if you know what I mean.
A touch of smarter, stupid. Mixed up in there.
So, Greg, we've cut back on our travel plans, both of us quite a bit, but we're still traveling here and there. What have you got coming up?
So I've been very pleased to be invited to visit Intel in the Oregon campus. Now, I found out today, apparently there's 2 Oregons in America. Is that right?
Well, as an American, there's only one Oregon that leaps to mind, which is the state in the upper west coast, kind of above California and below Washington State. Which one did you find?
Well, somebody said to me there was a couple of them, and I thought I should go and look at the maps. I'm not big on American geography, so.
I'm imagining if you're in Oregon, you're in Portland or nearby, big city of Portland in Oregon.
Okay. Well, I'm going to be in Hillsborough in Oregon around about the 12th and 13th of October, and I'm told that Oregon has a reputation for custom craft beer of some sort. Particular Matt Osborne was telling me about a particular porter that I should be getting into.
It's funny you say that. In one of my flights out, I ended up going through the Oregon airport, and there was a craft brew place in the airport of all places where you could get custom brews. As I recall, it wasn't too bad.
Oh, I see. So, Hillsborough's just next to
maybe
Portland.
You can do good.
So it's like
makes sense. Just like if you fly into Los Angeles, you're probably not going to be in Los Angeles. If you fly into San Francisco, you're probably not actually in San Francisco.
Oh, I see. It's halfway up the left-hand side. I know, sort of on the top left-hand side of America. Fair enough.
Yeah, mostly known for trees.
Okay. Well, there's trees everywhere, so it's a bit not very... All things considered, there's an awful lot of trees everywhere. Does that make it...
Maybe I'm just displaying my ignorance of Oregon, and there's people in that state listening to this going, Banks, just shut up, man.
So, if you're in Oregon,
and they'd be right.
If you're in or around Hillsborough, Portland, Oregon, around about the 12th to the 15th of October, I'll be hanging around there like a bad smell and drinking beer in substantial quantities. If you'd like to get together, let me know, and we might even turn it into a networking beers if we get enough interest. And then Del World. Yeah, I haven't been to Del World before. You and I have done VMworld and Cisco Live and those events, and when I got an invite from the Dell team to come down as an influencer, I thought I should go and take a look around the Dell world and find out what a Dell world looks like. I sort of think it's like a science fiction dystopia, you know, it's like a world building that you create all on your own and populate it with various characters and things, so it could be interesting to go and visit that.
It's funny. I'm just picturing it all in my mind. Scenes from Blade Runner popped into my head. Oh, that's great. Del World in Austin. So in all seriousness, what's interesting to me about Dell is the they are at a confluence of a lot of things, not just networking, which is kind of this new and added thing, but of course all the other stuff they do in building data centers and some of the markets that they're getting into, which we've been talking about a network break recently. So I think that's going to be a fun one. I think Drew might be there as well. I've forgotten if he's going to that one too. I think he is, though.
He is. You must have signed off on his travel approval, surely?
If he asked, I signed off, yeah. I've just lost track of who's going where in this crew of ours.
I think, I do also think because Dell is privately held, they can make interesting decisions and take interesting risks. Whereas, you know, the more traditional vendors like HP, Cisco, EMC, IBM, Oracle, they're all doing, you know, they're publicly traded. And then in a certain way, they're not allowed to make mistakes. Mm. And Dell is out there doing things like, you know, partnering with Big Switch for networking hardware while producing FTOS, their own operating system, you know, and Cumulus Linux and all those things. You wouldn't see Cisco or Arista taking that choice.
You wouldn't think, no, because, again, as you put it, beholden to the shareholders is a very, really heavily influences your decisions in ways that if you're privately held, you can take a risk for something that isn't going to pay off this quarter or this year or maybe even next year because you're playing the long game.
Unless you're Google, of course, and you form a new company called Alphabet.
You can do what you want.
You can do whatever the hell you like. You just take, there's so much money being squeezed out of the advertising market, you can just fund things like balloons, wireless balloons and stuff like that.
So my travel plans for the next couple months between now and the end of the year, I got one big thing on the calendar, which is I am due up for my CCIE recertification. I am not yet so long standing of a title holder to be able to go emeritus, and I'm still going to keep grinding away at my CCIE recerts until I can go emeritus, at which time I will. But I decided, because my last recert was just so bloody hard, and it just kind of reminded me that I needed to really go through some fundamental course stuff with an instructor and just rethink through all the things that I haven't had reason to think about for a while. So whereas in real life, I might work with, OSPF, but never ISIS and very little BGP, it might be good to just sit in a classroom and kind of grind away on that stuff for a while. And so I am going to go out to Glendale, California, where Narbit Kacharyans is going to fill my brain with CCIE level instruction for 10 days. I'm doing a 10-day boot camp. Every time I say 10 days, I asked Narbik in email, I said, should I do the 5-day or the 10-day? And he's like, well, you should do the 10-day. It will be fun. Okay.
For some new definition of fun that we've not thought about before, yeah.
Well, I am actually looking forward to it. Mm. Narbik is a really good instructor. I worked with him for his boot camps in 2008, 2007, 2008, before I took my lab back in the day. Mm. And I got a lot out of it. And so 10 days of drinking from the fire hose of Narbik's instruction and looking at the whiteboards, reviewing all the stuff I know, going over some stuff I don't, and doing lab work has got to be good for me. And I think it's a really key step to being in the spirit of the CCIE recertification, which is not just you pass the stupid test again, but you actually are keeping up. That is the point of the recert program, right? Yep. You're keeping up with current technology. And I wish this show was all it took for me to keep up, but the level of stupid minutiae and trivia you have to know to pass that dumb test. Anyway, that's one travel thing that's happening in mid-October. And then I am looking at the OPNFV summit that's happening in November. I've got an invite sitting in my mailbox and I haven't decided what I'm going to do yet. Mm-hmm. I'll chat about that with the family and see. That is interesting to me. I mean, it's going to be mostly a telco-oriented project, but open platform for NFV is important. They've got a lot of hooks into the open daylight controller project.
There's a whole subculture developing there, isn't there? That, you know, that OpNFV is, it's more than just SDN, which is controller, switches, you know, this port in that VLAN, this virtual switch in that VLAN type thing. We're getting much more out to the, you know, how do I get VMs and with virtual instances of firewalls and load balancers and do something useful with all of that.
And it's a platform that is answering questions that, for example, OpenStack is not answering. Mm. You know, it's, you know, OPNFV is really going after that virtualized network function space and building a platform that you can plug in any NFV function into and then have it be a standard, a baseline across the industry, kind of like the role that Open Daylight is fulfilling for a lot of vendors out there. Yep. As well. Yep. And I don't want to leave out Onos, which is still making noise and making progress and got some adherence as far as controllers go. But OPNFV doesn't have any competition that I know of. No other rival projects have kicked off yet thus far. But anyway, that summit's happening in November out on the West Coast somewhere, I believe, and I'm thinking about going to that one, and we'll see. Okay. The West Coast is such a drag, man.
Well, speaking about NFV, Cloud Router, which was a product we talked about a couple of months ago when the version 1 came out, has gone into production. So let's talk networking instead of waffling on about you and me, because nobody cares about us, right? And Cloud Router 2 has shipped, which is they're calling their production-ready virtual router. So this is a Linux instance that does routing, has all of the things that you want in there, BGP, Bird, Quagga to do, BGP, OSPF, MPLS, and all that sort of thing. It also has some basic IPsec and VPN type functionality for various aspects of that capability if you want. And it's fit for purpose in Docker, which I think is very interesting. So imagine spawning a routing instance in Docker for 10 minutes and then turning it back off again. That could have some interesting ideas.
Well, that is interesting because I haven't kept up with it, and I know it's a fast-moving space, but Docker networking doesn't seem like something that would lend itself very well to such a process as Cloud Router because the pieces and parts in Docker networking just weren't there for this level of functionality. But maybe I've lost touch with what all is going on and how the socket plane guys are doing with integration.
Well, in this case, you could run... Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you got to get the physical... Well, the logical interfaces of the router legs into the operating system underneath. But it's already part of ONOS, which is an SDN platform, and increasingly ONS is becoming an NFV platform. So it's a fork of Open Daylight that's carrier-ready, and AT&T's putting a lot of effort and resources into that project, if we remember right. So,
well, ONOS is not a fork of ODL, no. That it's a ground-up, completely different animal. Mm. Distributed architecture, build a cluster of machines that make up that controller function, and then different controller functions are spawned across different members of the cluster. And so it's intended to be highly scalable for a lot of operations per second that you're asking the controller to do, which if you're trying to centralize all the things, and you're a carrier, I guess that's pretty important. Been some question with ONOS about performance in the early days. I'm sure they're working on that. Mm. But no, it is, I would say, a rival to ODL as opposed to a fork of it.
I thought it was very much service provider centric and sort of discarded. Discarded anything that was sort of, whereas ODL is more enterprise centric. But anyway, what I do find interesting about this is the idea that a router can be an open source project. A software router can be an open source project, and that's not something that we've historically talked about. I've always been thinking Juniper, you know, Junos as a VM, Cisco IOS XR as a VM, Brocade's Viata as a VM, and I still have to go and buy that routing software and get licenses for it. you know, we are seeing the emergence of routing code as open source, which could be very interesting.
And I think the service providers that have been using this kind of stuff for a long time, it's not new for some of these folks to be using a server as a BGP route reflector and, you know, running complex policies and so on, and it's all sitting on some Linux box instead of some big old router. You know, for me, it's the viability of the code. So here's a case in point. I've been playing a little bit with Cumulus Linux VX in my lab. It's the lab flavor of Cumulus Linux. It's just basically their Cumulus's code with the hardware abstraction layer that they usually run stripped out. So you can just run the thing as a VM and do a configuration. It's Quagga underneath. That's part of it. So to configure BGP, it's kind of Cisco iOS-like Quagga is. And it wasn't really all that complex to configure. And it made me think the leap over to Cumulus from Cisco would not be all that hard for anybody who's competent, knows what the machine's supposed to do, and they don't just have to work off of some script. You can really get configured on a Linux box in a hurry. It wasn't even that difficult. So maybe it's more viable than most of us think. It's just we're so used to buying from, as you were saying, you know, the Ciscos and the Junipers, that it's hard to break that habit.
I guess in my head, I knew you could always get Linux and turn it and make it root, but I never thought of it as router, like a commercial, like you could go and get it and replace your existing routers. Cloud Router is on the path to do that. So I'd still believe that there are times when you want to have a commercial router in a network, and there are times when an open source router might work for you. So I'll be continuing to track that. Now, VMworld has come and gone. Aside from a couple of announcements around NSX 6.2, there wasn't any networking fire that I thought. Did you see much?
I didn't see much. The biggest thing, I think we talked about a network break, was the Evo Rack product has been rebranded to Evo SDDC, and that product for networking includes a partnership with Cumulus Linux now, where it's a Cumulus Linux networking stack that's been fully integrated into the product. So you don't have to interact with Cumulus Linux unless you want to. You can. It's there. But single pane of glass, you can configure the networking. But aside from that, I didn't hear much. And in fact, some of our friends that are at VMworld have kind of said, you know, the people, the community, it's been great for that aspect, but the show itself, not too exciting.
I saw one article from somebody saying that the whole of the show floor was storage companies. And considering that there's so many storage startups, it's not hardly surprising. And there's no storage show anywhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, there used to be Storage World, or there used to be a storage thing, and it kind of died because really there was only EMC and NetApp left standing. And the resurgence of startups means there's nowhere for them to go but VMworld and to get to customers, really, and that's what they were.
Well, that's really interesting you put it that way. EMC and NetApp are the only ones left standing, or were the only ones left standing, but they haven't been innovating especially. And so now you've got all these startups that are doing new and interesting things, as EMC and NetApp both have been accused of stumbling and still being very expensive for what they are.
Well, EMC's got some new stuff. It's got the Viper and a few other bits and pieces, but they're all punishingly expensive. They're taking the top end of the market and leaving stuff away. One of the things I did notice was that Martin Casado, I haven't been able to find any links to this as yet. So if you're listening from VMware and you've got some links, send them to me. But NSX 6.2 was announced, and then they also stood up on stage and demoed a few things. One of them was vCloud Air with its hybridity functions. So the hybridity.
Hybridity, yes.
New the word. Amount of cloud hybrid you can support is your hybridity index. Kill me now. And but basically, they've added a bunch of stuff to NSX, which allows you to move VMs from your data center to your vCloud Air environment. And VMware wants to take all the money that you currently spend on DR data center. So you shouldn't own a DR data center, is what they're now saying. You should own a private cloud, but your backup private cloud should be in their physical, in their cloud. So you only have one premises to do that, and everything's backed up in a, you know, second-rate mode over in a second facility. Now, that sounds really sexy. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking someday soon they're going to announce WAN optimization or SD-WAN, because they're on their way with this sort of a solution. So I just get this feeling that NSX is moving very, very quickly. They have a 3 or 4 year head start on ACI, for example, and getting into the WAN through this hybrid cloud is a thing. And the main thing that I saw from Martin Casado's keynote was Amazon VPC integration. So NSX can now not only perform hybrid cloud from vCloud Air to your private data center, but it can also now do Amazon VPC networking, which is a pretty big deal. So now vCloud can manage your OpenStack. You can do a vCloud OpenStack thing. You can now do vCloud Air as an offsite private cloud, and you can now bring in your Amazon space into one orchestrated thing. So that's a big deal.
That is a theme we've been seeing with several other the SDN-related vendors as well. It's just this automated integration with cloud in some way. So you can ship your virtual machines off to public cloud, have that happen automatically, bring them back in, and have it all done on a policy basis. So be curious to know how many people are actually doing that. Is that just a limited number of people with a specific use case where they do that? Or is that kind of like everybody, oh, everybody does that. We're all thinking about that. I kind of think maybe not so much, which actually kind of brings me to another point here. I caught an article in Cisco's blog, I think yesterday, that was, no, it was actually this morning, on statistics about companies moving to the cloud. And so they had a guest post by a 451, that analyst firm, 451, and some research that they did. And they point out that, you know, everybody talks about all these companies that are moving to the cloud, right? Oh, everybody's, you know, getting, they're not going to own their own data center anymore. We even talked about this at Interop last year at a panel I moderated. Mm. And their research says, yeah, it's growing. People are moving to cloud, but it's not really all that fast. And then they've got a chart here that shows today, 8% of hosting is done at some cloud service provider, about 11% happens at a colo, and then 81% is on premises, where you own the facility that your stuff is in. Means, so just roughly saying, 8 out of 10 companies, they host their own stuff. And then the remaining are spread out across either cloud or in a colo facility. And if it's colo, it's practically the same as owning your own stuff, really. Because you do. You still have to own it and manage it. And that doesn't have any indication of using cloud or that you are cloud. It just means you decided not to have your own square footage. So you farm that out to someone else. Over the next 3 years, they're projecting that this ratio of 81%, 11%, and 8% is going to change to 65% on-premises, 15% colo, and 21% cloud service provider. Yeah. That's 3 years from now. So meaning it's, again, shifting, but it's pretty slow. You know, so, I mean, there's reasons you wouldn't want to move. You know, reliability is a thing. I worked in a company that we had our facilities coloed, did not own any of our square footage for data center processing. And keeping things in the colo meant that between the main headquarters where the office space was and the colo downtown, we had to have dedicated fiber and to have the bandwidth. And if that fiber got cut, you were screwed. Really sucked. We were cut off from everything because we didn't have any servers inside.
You didn't have a redundant fiber path, is what you're saying.
No, well, there wasn't money in the budget for that. So we were literally hanging off of one piece of fiber. And of course, even if you have the money for a redundant path into the colo, you have to make sure that it's physically going to a different part of the city. So that's a concern. Not everybody's going to have facilities to support you in that sort of redundancy requirement. So reliability is a thing.
Yeah, see,
security is a thing,
right?
Dude,
if everybody went into hybrid cloud, I mean, there's just not enough bandwidth in the world to make that work. I'm sure of it. You know, if everybody shifts to a 10 gig internet connection, imagine how much bandwidth you've got to get into the cloud providers to be able to, you know, replace your, you know, move. If you move your stuff into cloud providers, how much bandwidth do you need to make that happen?
It's interesting that you put it that way. If you think about streaming as well, and the amount of bandwidth that is consumed on the internet for streaming, how can a carrier possibly keep up with these things? And so this 3-year time horizon gives them plenty of time to build out, gives 100 gig Ethernet an opportunity to rise, gives 400 gig Ethernet an opportunity to rise.
They're not.
And start slamming 100
gig,
bandwidth.
I mean, 100 gig Ethernet isn't here yet. I think there was a press release this week about Mellanox, who released a proprietary card and a proprietary 100 gig standard because that makes sense for them right now to get that out the door. And 400 gig isn't predicted to even finish the standardizations process until 2018, I think. And they still haven't started.
But if there's 100 gig and we assume channelized 100 gig should translate to 400 gig in some proprietary way pretty quickly for the Verizons and tier ones of the world that need it, I would suspect.
I don't think so. I don't think that, you know, and not to mention that if you start clocking those rates, if you start clocking 400 gig on a PHY, you've got to have something that can transmit at that speed rate, right? So 40 gig, the original version of 40 gig was actually 410 gig channels. And you have to send pulses down the light wave at 10 gigabits per second. And then eventually they got it up to 40 gigabits per second. So now you can run 40 gig on one pair. The first version of 100 gig was 10 by 10. Then it's 4 by 25.
Yep. And that's really what I'm saying for 400 too. But I guess that makes, if you're having to transmit across multiple fibers, you're not really increasing your capacity.
No, if you end up with 8 by 50s, to get 400 gig or 16 by 25.
Sure.
You know, you're talking about an awful lot of hardware that has to drive those, because you've got to have a multiplexer to get those channels all together into one, and it's got to happen in the PHY layer, and you've got to power all of those lasers, right? So if you're pouring 100 watts into an SFP, you're only going to have two of them per line card. So yeah, I'm not sure that there's enough bandwidth in the world to start and things like, you know, where they talk about these data backup companies saying, oh, yeah, you just back all your data up to the cloud and into Amazon's S3, and, you know, there's these new providers out there. If you start shifting terabytes of data over the internet and, you know, I'm just not sure there's that much bandwidth in the internet if we all started to do that.
It means more localized data centers. You solve the problem by pushing everything closer to everybody else than having to do some kind of back-end synchronization.
But data centers take 5 to 10 years. From the time that you start, you know, if you're thinking like Amazon or Google or, you know, any of the big cloud providers or even the second tier like, you know, Joyend or Rackspace or whatever, you've got to find a piece of land to buy. It's going to take you 2 or 3 years to determine which piece of land you can buy, whether it's got power, is it, you know, safe physically from earthquakes and floods, and then you've got to buy it. That's a year. That can take a year. If the land is already occupied, it could take a couple of years for people to exit the land. And then you've got to design the data center, build it, get approvals with the local councils.
You know what the problem here is, really? It's a data explosion because none of us can friggin' delete anything. We've got gigabytes of data in our mailboxes. We've got stuff kicking around our file systems because we just can't delete anything. I got to have version control. And I'm going to keep the last 50 versions
Google
of
Mail.
Whatever it is.
Have you ever tried deleting a mail out of Google Mail? You know when you press delete?
Well, I use IMAP and it's
no,
okay.
It's still there.
It works for me.
Have you ever been into your all mail folder and found it's still there?
Well, I know there's a retention policy I had to set that if I move it to the trash after 30 days, it would
still
go
there
away
in
forever.
Mail.
Yeah. Really?
It has another folder called All Mail, and unless you delete it from there, it doesn't actually delete it at all. Drives me bats.
So, hey, moving on to another subject here. Here's some just basic, good old-fashioned troubleshooting common sense. So I follow a whole bunch of folks on Twitter, and here's a tweet from The Data Plumber, who I actually met at Networking Field Day 10. Andy from the UK, good guy. So at The Data Plumber tweets, 0.5 hours troubleshooting an IS-IS adjacency issue, found intermediate switch MTU was too small. A useful reminder to start with the basics. Yeah, because of course, if a router doesn't form an adjacency, what are you going to do? Start looking at logs. Why didn't it come up? What happened? And you figure it's a configuration problem. It's this, it's that. And nope, switch MTU too small. Packets not reaching each other. And again, start with the basics. And another one from network_Phil. Awesome. I just snaked 15 feet of copper through ridiculous cable management to the wrong patch panel. Is it beer o'clock yet? Poor guy.
You know what I love about
we've
that
we've all
previous
done these
tweet?
Things.
Only an engineer would write 0.5 hour. There's someone who fills out a timesheet, right? It's not 30 minutes.
You got to meet Andy. He's kind of vaguely close to you in the sense that everybody in the UK is close to each other in my mind because I don't live there. And he likes a good stout, so you guys should
hang out
sometime.
I just thought it was funny. There's someone who fills out a timesheet. That's not 30 minutes. That's 0.5 hours.
So then here's me troubleshooting a Google Apps problem yesterday. I'm trying to reset a password on a site called Zapier that I used for some social media stuff, and I can't get the password reset email. It's not coming through.
I'm getting messages from you at midnight saying,
So I'm thinking through, why am I not getting the email? And, you know, well, there was a problem with Amazon Web Services today with another service that I use, and AWS was slow. Maybe AWS routes this email, and somehow it was a problem. Or maybe the Google spam filter was catching the password reset. And since this is going to a Google DL, I wonder if, you know, how do you even check something like that? I don't know. It's sand people. I don't know what it is. And then I dug into it, and all it was a friggin' checkbox on the distribution list that wouldn't allow public postings from the internet to be posted to the list. That's all it was. It was just a checkbox. So the point here of all these tweets and my little story is, don't forget the basics, everyone. Remember to think through the common sense things that you need to think through. Check your work carefully and assume nothing. Don't go for the hard stuff until you've checked the easy
stuff. Yeah, I did that just yesterday. Traced out the cables and then realized they were actually going to where I put them the first time, not where I thought they were the second time. Because I can see, I swore it was in port 21. And when I went downstairs, no, it was in port 22. For some reason, my mind had gone. And then I looked down at the diagram I'd drawn on a piece of paper. And you know what port was written down there? 22. Just my brain had 21.
Yep.
So whatever was on port 21 was having a bad day for about half an hour.
So you got another article you wrote down here about Intel Omnipath and a post-InfiniBand world. What the heck is Intel Omnipath?
I'm not 100% sure, and I guess this is one of the reasons I'm going to visit Oregon in October. but it looks to me, I still haven't had a chance to really, really get into this, but it looks like the successor to InfiniBand, and it's a direct RDMA, remote direct memory access. So if you're a networking person and you've probably only ever heard about Ethernet if you're in the industry today, and if you're not old and grumpy like us, then you might have forgotten that there are other in networking technologies that are not Ethernet, like Token Ring and FDDI and ARCNET and so forth. Well, InfiniBand is one of the survivors. And now the big thing about InfiniBand is not just that the PHY layer is very fast. You know, they've been doing 40 gig and 100, and there's even 120 gig quad data rate InfiniBand today. But the big thing about InfiniBand is it's very, very low latency on the wire. And then also it's ability to use a protocol stack which uses remote direct memory access. That is, you can write from an application on one server directly into the operating memory of the other one.
Yeah.
And of course, if you're writing software and you're writing directly into the memory of another CPU or another VM or an OS or whatever, then your performance is vastly accelerated because the other machine doesn't have to read the packet, decode the data, go through the SAR segmentation and reassembly, put it up to the TCP, TCP packs, it gives it to them. This just says, put that straight over there. So your transaction latency very low. Of course, your software has to support RDMA. And if you're into HPC, this is what you're all about. So no Ethernet, no IP, just write directly to the over there. With the rise of Ethernet and the fact that Ethernet's getting so cheap to use, and having an InfiniBand network is actually quite a painful thing because at the end of the day, you have to get off InfiniBand into Ethernet. And so you're stuck with servers which have an Ethernet adapter and an Ethernet and an InfiniBand adapter, and they sort of act like these very low performance gateways. They run like rubbish. And so increasingly, the HPC or the high performance compute people are turning to Ethernet instead. And so I've deployed a 1500 port, 10 gig port network for HPC, and they love it. They say, we're never going back to InfiniBand because it costs so much and it's painful to use. Okay, great. But Intel Omnipath looks like successor to this. And more importantly, it allows you to run RDMA over the top. So if you're running these RDMA or MPIO applications, then you can do that. The second thing is that it's a combination of NICs and hardware and software components. So there's now an open source movement to get the RDMA code into open source so that you can use it. And a part of the offshoot of this is the NVMe. So if you're into storage, there's this new way of connecting SSDs to the CPU that avoids the old legacy SATA interfaces, which are now no longer fast enough. As SSDs get bigger and bigger and faster, the old interface isn't going to work. And the NVMe is a sort of intended to be like a fabric. Now, it is loosely related to Omnipath as well. So I think what I understand today is that Omnipath is a post-InfiniBand world. It's an RDMA technology. There's an offshoot of technologies around it like NVMe for SSDs and a couple of other different things. I think what we're seeing is a fabric to go on the motherboard. Remember, I've been talking over the last couple of years for we're going to see a fabric chip on the motherboard, and actually whether it'll be Ethernet or something else, instead of connecting your network adapter onto the PCI bus, there'll be some other bus. I think this might be it.
Your notes here mentioned PCIe, which, you mentioned NVMe, and big high bandwidth bus now of things that plug into the PCIe bus. So that makes sense that that's the bus that would be used for an application such as this in these high bandwidth.
I just wanted to flag it to people to say, if you're building HPC infrastructures, and increasingly in the enterprise world we are, especially if you're building Hadoop type, clustering engines or those types of big data map outs that do that, so I can't think of the words straight away, but if you're building high performance fabrics for that, now most likely you're building a separate switching infrastructure, or you should be building a separate switching infrastructure for that if you've got any brains, because your normal Cisco stuff is going to be too high in latency and too expensive. You need to have a separate fabric over here for that. This might be something that you should look at because it could go a hell of a lot faster. We're talking several orders of magnitude faster than Ethernet can go.
Now, you've had some ideas that we've been talking about in the back channel. You've had this analogy that you've been building in your mind about big companies like Cisco and HP and EMC as a supermarket. So I want you to expand on this idea, because I can tell as I've watched the evolution of this, as you've been kicking this around, that you continue to mature this idea in your mind.
The thing is, so what's driving me to this is, first of all, you look at companies like HP and Cisco particularly, and Dell, and you know all that, and once they have different strategies, different BUs, and they kind of, I find it very difficult to understand which BU is doing what. And a lot of the times the actual business units overlap each other and they actually compete with each other. And now, if I remember rightly, sort of there was a fashion about 15 years ago to let the business, you know, if you own 100% of a market, having two business units fighting over it, that's good for business, because you always win, right? So,
yes.
I'm not sure that's actually... I don't think that's relevant in my going forward. I think we're going to see less and less of this, you know, overlapping business units like what Cisco does, you know, 4,500, 6,800, 7,700, 9,000.
Yeah, Catalyst versus Nexus versus ACI.
Yeah, I think, you know, some of those have to die. I just don't think that's sustainable going forward. And but it sort of struck me that, so if you've got multiple business units and now you start to have partnerships, so we're seeing a big, big push with the SDN companies. You know, ACI has got this big brag slide of partners, you know, F5, Checkpoint.
Yeah, it's the ecosystem thing. That's right. Yeah, I've written about this in Network World, I think. But yeah, the ecosystems are a big thing. You've got to have that partnership.
But
so
if you're F5, you've also got a partnership with HP and their SDN App Store, and you've got a partnership with Big Switch, and you've got a partnership with Brocade and the Open Daylight Controller, and you've got... So actually, it's not an ecosystem. It's more like a supermarket where you go down this aisle and here's, you know, here I am in the Brocade, you know, Viata aisle, and here on the left is the Brocade Viata router, and over here is the firewall, and on the right-hand side, just behind the service source is the, you know, and then down the back here is all of the, so that's the own brand shelves, you know, and then behind that is the F5, and here's the Checkpoint partnership, here's the Fortinets, here's the, and, you know, down as you go down the aisle. The challenge here is, it makes sense for big companies to keep growing, because they always have to keep growing, to develop multiple strategies and products. At the same time, we're seeing hyper-converged hardware or hyper-converged platforms suddenly say all of the things that are separate line items, just shrink them down. So it's a bit like you go down the shampoo aisle and you can buy shampoo and conditioner, or you can buy combined shampoo and conditioner, right? That's hyper-converged, really. You like that?
Yeah.
I just shrank an entire billion-dollar market segment down to anti-dandruff shampoo and conditioner.
Well done.
Genius. Genius, I tell you. But public...
I'd pat you on the back, but you're doing a good job.
But really what you're looking at, you know, when I go to a supermarket, you think about, well, you go to the supermarket and you expect to buy one of everything. Now, do you go to the supermarket? Is it the supermarket that you're buying from, or are you buying the product that's in the supermarket?
Well, you're buying the product that's in the supermarket.
Yeah, sometimes.
You're working out with a product.
Except if you're the supermarket owner, in which case you care about the supermarket more than you do the product.
Of course. And you stock as many products as you think to attract people to come into your place of business. So I'll just give you an example of that. And I don't know how this works in the UK, but in America, we've seen the grocery stores start to stock products that, like personal care products, shampoo and soap and these kind of things, not just food items. The idea being, if we make it a one-stop shop, we will, for convenience sake, they'll buy their shampoo here, and they'll overcharge for it. It's not but for convenience, you'll buy it and pay the extra just so you don't have to make a trip to wherever it might be, you know, cheapest. So, but just all supporting your point, the supermarket owner cares about how much volume he's putting through the supermarket, not about the individual products necessarily. Whatever products you got to put out there to keep people buying from you.
But what the customer cares about is the product, not the supermarket. And there's a massive disconnect there, right?
Right.
So now, when it comes to shampoo, it's pretty easy to use shampoo, and you pretty much know what you're getting, right? But if you're buying a hyper-converged private cloud platform that's got 15 vendors in partnership together, I'm not sure the supermarket model is going to sustain over time. So if you take the principle of, you know, the supermarket's business model is focused on stacking them high and selling them in volume to keep the doors open on the supermarket infrastructure, right? So Cisco has John Chambers at the top of the pile and a whole bunch of highly paid executives, and then underneath them is you know, all of the heads of the business units, and Chuck Robbins as CEO, and then you've got the sales managers and then the marketing engines, and you've got, you know, there's all this overhead before you actually get down to the product piece. All of those people in all of those layers, all of those costs associated with them is all born in the product itself. There's a tension there between I've got to keep the supermarket going and keep the stock on the shelf, so I'll just go and get rid of my Cisco Ace and replace it with F5 because the Cisco Ace isn't selling very well. But where does that leave customers in the end? Do customers choose the supermarket and then say, I just continue to go back to the Cisco supermarket and buy all my networking equipment? Or do I say, you know, the Brocade supermarket over here sells the F5, but I'll go to the HP supermarket for their switches? Or do we have both models?
Well, I think there's both, because not all of the partnerships are tightly coupled. Some of them are functional partnerships. You're not actually buying product on a single SKU from multiple vendors at the Cisco supermarket. You're buying ACI, which happens to tightly integrate with several different products because they've done the work on the back end to, oh, you also an F5 customer? Great. You can do some AC, you can do some integration between your F5 infrastructure and your ACI infrastructure, but you're not actually buying F5 product from Cisco, as opposed to some of the other relationships like VMware with SDDC, the Evo SDDC, where you're buying a converged rack that's got all the things in it, including product from Cumulus Linux.
But on the other hand, if you go to the supermarket and they've got a buy five, get it for the price of three deal.
That's where you're going with that analogy.
So if you look at, you know, Cisco ACI does a special deal with F5 to give you a discounted F5 load balancer functionality.
So are there those kind of deals going on, or are you speculating?
I'm saying that's the next step. You start to get into, like, how do I differentiate my supermarket deal from the deal from coming from the next aisle over?
Right. Yeah,
it's not a perfect metaphor, but it is sort of the way of making sure that as the companies, and I think we're going to see a rationalization in the industry as a lot of products just disappear and customers are going to be less than pleased. You know, like, how many server models can you make? How many storage arrays can a market support? Because you go into the supermarket, you don't find, you know, shampoo puts the lie to that. There's always 20 varieties of shampoo for some reason that defeats me. Have you ever looked at your notice? Right?
We are spoiled for choice and it's ridiculous. Yes.
But if you go down the sugar aisle, there's only one sugar, or maybe two. Right?
Not in America.
You know my love of American supermarkets.
People listen to the show, you should know, because Greg visited America and stayed at my house for about a week earlier in the year. He was just mystified and entertained by a number of our grocery store products. And so since then, I've taken to seeing this and that I thought would amuse him and sending him pictures of some of our food. I think the latest thing I sent you was these supersized hot dogs that were like sausages, but they were hot dogs.
Well, I mean, awesome. I've been looking at doing that diet where you go into the protein only, like you go very heavy into the meat sort of a thing. I can't afford to do it over here because it's just too expensive. In America, easiest pie.
I believe it.
Meat's cheap over there. But dude, but over here, there's just not enough money in the world to make that happen. No, American supermarket.
So not a perfect metaphor, I guess, but yeah, I think you make a good point. And it is a strategy that plays to the brand strengths of some of these major players like Cisco. For however much grief they get from the shareholder community when they have an off quarter, or however much grief they get from people who say, oh, you're not, you know, forward thinking enough in certain technologies or this or that, they have huge brand cachets still, and it's another way to help maintain brand loyalty by forging these partnerships and building out these ecosystems or supermarkets, as you put it. I think it makes sense that we are seeing some of that, and why wouldn't we see more of that going forward? Because it's I think it's a growth strategy. I think it's going back to the whole shareholder thing. And making shareholders happy. Well, how do you do that when you're a huge company that already owns a significant part of the market? Well, this is one way you can contribute to growth in the bottom line by forging partnerships, keeping people within the fold, and giving them more functionality that they would pay for.
And it's also, as the market matures, and also, you know, you've still got a corner shop. So I think of resellers as like the corner shop. You know, the only thing you buy from them is milk and a bag of crisps. And increasingly, you'll start to buy more and more directly from the big supermarket because you can buy better in bulk. But I guess ultimately, it's like trying to understand how companies like Cisco and HP stay relevant in an industry where we converge, where if hyperconvergence continues, so that is instead of buying your servers and your storage and your NICs and your switches individually, you'll go and buy a rack at a time, even if you're an enterprise, which is where we're headed with Nutanix and SimpliVity and Scale.io and this Evo SDDC. Yeah. then how do the big companies then make sure that they capture more of the customer? You know, how do they continue to grow? Well, they have to say, would you like fries with that? Maybe you could pick up a bag of crisps when you, and make sure there is no customization, make sure the resellers don't get to sell things that are off-brand, you know, or whatever. And I just think the supermarket thing is a pretty close metaphor, because ultimately supermarkets are a very efficient way of distributing products to where they need to be, and the cost of the sale is much lower than what we have today. Today what we have is a bunch of, you know, handcrafted, manual sold by resellers with limited understanding of their products trying to offer you. And that was the way we had to do it before the internet. But I think now the internet is here. Customers often know more about what they're buying than the resellers do. They want to just be able to say, I'll buy an Evo SDDC from HP. Click, rack turns up, ready to go. Okay, but I mean, enough of that, because as you say, the metaphor is still not perfect. I need to keep polishing that. I want to highlight you to an article I read today from William Quass. Now, William, he writes on a blog called SIWDT. I've got no idea what that stands for. But he works now for Plexi. It's his fourth or fifth startup in the last 15 to 20 years. And
Bill Quass.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I know Bill. I wouldn't say I know him well, but I've met him a number of times and we've chatted. Right. Yeah.
So he has a section here. I'm just going to read this piece here. He said, what's really hard is showing up at a Fortune 500 company and trying to convince the networking team to choose a new networking vendor after 15 years of building the same network with products from the same vendor. I had one person tell me that his kid was dating the kid from the sales rep of the incumbent vendor as they lived in the same town and went to the same school. That's a hard sales challenge to overcome, right?
Yes.
Your salesperson and your daughter and their son is dating, right? If you'd walk away from that, that's pretty difficult. The second paragraph, and this is the one that's really, really telling, I believe. I also find that networking people are very much stuck in the land of 2004 from a knowledge and careers perspective. There is clearly a lot of career frustration for a network engineer who is in the 35 to 45 age range. The world is changing around them, and many have told me that they feel they have plateaued from a career and income perspective. I've had one network architect at a large financial company tell me that he'd been building data centers with Cisco for 20 years. He was 45 and was planning to build one last data center and sees no reason to do anything different at this point in his life. So that's the end of the quote. Can I just go off and bang my head on the wall? Like, that is the most miserable piece of information I've read this year. But it's true.
I'm sitting here shaking my head because I'm in that range, right? 35 to 45. I get it. And I've invested a lot of time over the years in learning how to build networks in a particular way. And yes, the world is changing. We've chronicled here on Packet Pushers over the last 5 odd years. And at the same time, the problem is it is very difficult to change because networking is hard. And to learn how to build a network that is as reliable, trustworthy, that you understand how it works and therefore you can troubleshoot it when it breaks and you know how to scale it and add new elements to it. You know how to document it and so on is years of experience and real world hands-on work, blood and sweat. Literally blood in my case is left in a data center in Salem, New Hampshire from racking equipment. And then changing to a world of some other controller and different ways of controlling how data is being forwarded through the infrastructure and software and all these that you can't see. It isn't standard necessarily controlling things. That's tough. And, you know, all these different ways of doing multi-tenancy, whether it's the old school MPLS way that service providers have been doing it and know how that works, or all this new stuff with VXLAN and controllers that are setting that up. It's not just that the world is changing. It's just you don't even know what horse to bet on now. You know not everything's going to survive, but what the heck are you supposed to do? Incredibly frustrating. And so the easy thing is, screw it. I'm just going to build you an underlay. I'll know how it works, and you can layer whatever the heck you want on top of it. Just leave me out of it.
And I know I've said this plenty of times before, right, is that a lot of networking has been stagnant for more than 15 years. In fact, part of the motivation for starting the blog and the podcast was to sort of, you know, rattle a cage about changing networking to adopt new stuff and think about new stuff. But to read this still makes me sad. To say that there's no appetite for change, I'm just going to do the same stuff as I did 20 years ago, makes me, in an industry which is supposedly changing all the time, it's innovating constantly.
I actually agree with that side of it as well. I mean, I think you and I are in a weird spot, though, because we happen to talk to vendors all the time who are doing the new stuff, and startups come on as sponsors and want to talk about their products, and we have the opportunity to dive in with the engineers and figure out the nuts and bolts of what they're doing and how it's new and interesting, and also how it's the same as what we've been used to. And so I get that. I am excited about virtualization and the opportunity I have to run a lab on my workstation that lets me play with new stuff. And but still, trying to translate all of this new stuff into production and the incredible stress that it brings upon a network engineer, because everything else in the data center anticipates a very reliable network. And if you put in something new and it isn't reliable, who wants that? Who wants the headache? I get it.
If you're bailing out the boat because there's a hole in the bottom and you can't get to the bottom to fix the hole, it's time to get out of the bloody boat. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you just condemned networking, saying that it's a leaky boat that we got.
We got to just get out of the boat.
Like, it's that it's that bad, and we have to change. I don't think.
If you're telling me today that you're deploying a Nexus 7700 infrastructure, or if you're deploying a factory MLAG infrastructure in your data center this year, then you better. That just makes me sad, because you don't need to. You don't need to replace your entire data center with one network. It doesn't have to be one network anymore. You can have lots of little ones and bond them all together into one network. You don't need to go and buy a huge chassis switch to go in the middle and then tie it together and tie the control planes together and then MLAG it and then turn it into a spanning tree root bridge. Go and buy,
I completely agree with you. And in fact, if I were being asked to design data centers going forward, that would be my strategy. The Lego approach, pieces and parts in a standardized, templated way, and expect design it such that when you have to do software upgrades or hardware upgrades or replacements, you can do it without it being hugely impactful. Yep. That's, all the technology is there to do that now.
You just don't... You don't have to. I mean, 20 years ago, we had to replace the entire data network at once, because the only way to build a reliable spanning tree was to do it all at once. In 2015, 20 years on, five cycles of product development, we just don't need to do that. Just go and build an ECMP core over here and bolt the two together and get started.
And I'll just go back to the fact that I think not everybody does it the same way. And so it used to be, and Cisco was the default standard, you'd go through that training, and so many engineers have that exact story. I learned how to build a network the Cisco way. That's how I build it. That's what I trust. And you just lived in that cycle. Now, if you want to go outside of that world, which is very easy to do with tons of really good options, you can, but how are you going to learn how to do it, and who's going to help you? Because everyone else runs Cisco, so who's going to help?
I must also feel sorry for the networking guy who's had 20 years of being beat up on because of his crappy protocols and crappy equipment. Why wouldn't you go with the pain you know, so at least you feel like you're in control, even though you don't? I mean, that's ultimately what it is, right? But anyway, so one final thing, I've got a tip for you. I got a new app today. You know how I'm big keen on Mac App Store and buying new apps and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, gosh, you and apps and fonts. Apps and fonts
okay,
with you.
Well, I've got one of each then, just to torment you. Okay. I found a link to an app, a new font called Hack. There'll be a list.
Oh, yes, I've seen this. I'm actually running this in my terminal software now to get used to it.
It's pretty good, right?
It's designed for source code, was the intent. If you're a quote-unquote hacker, slang for someone who codes, then try this font. It's free. And I tweeted about this as well. We must have stumbled on the same article. I think I found mine on Ars Technica.
Yep.
It's a great little font.
It's free, so it means you can install it into your Windows without offending anybody at work. Free and open, sorry. Not just free to buy, but open to use, so there's no license. Anything is an improvement on the Windows CLI fonts, because they couldn't get any worse than the blooming Courier font that Microsoft produces. It's rubbish.
So that's the Hack
font. It's a Hack font. I can highly recommend it to you. Get a hold of it and start using it. It is very good. Although I still use Source Code Pro a lot from Adobe, which is very visually pleasing as well. I have a range of them. Actually, Consolas is still my very favorite, but that's a commercial font. But the one app I really want to tell you about is one called Annotate. Now, you and I have started to share more and more little screen grabs of our screen. Take a little screenshot and put it up there somewhere for you. Make it easier to see, right?
Yeah, I actually use Evernote's Sketch app for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I used to use Sketch, but then it's telling Evernote everything I want, everything I do. So Evernote's really, really big about selling your personal details to everybody else, and you need to have a login to make it work, blah, blah, blah. And it's not very good, I think, in the end of the day. So this one's called Annotate. It's about $2 on the Mac App Store. It allows you to upload to Dropbox, so you can take a snapshot, you can annotate it with a draw or a fuzz or whatever you like. You can click on it and it'll go direct to tweet. You can say direct to Twitter. You can say send it straight to an email. Oh, there's a bunch.
And it's a local app, not a cloud app with a login or any of that stuff. Now, that might be enough motivation for me to get off Sketch. I've been using Sketch because I used to use Evernote and it integrated well. I haven't been using Evernote for well over a year now, I don't think. So this might be, maybe I'll
go try it. Couple of bucks. In the 7 days that I've owned it, they've already added new actions. So you can now integrate with a service. So I'm using Dropbox, but also integrates with Cloud App. And then this week, they announced an update to integrate with Zendesk. Now, I don't use Zendesk, but hey, there you go. Like it a lot. Highly recommend it to you. It was originally, I've been using another app called Gluey for about 4 years now, and this is the replacement for Gluey. This is the upgrade and a new thing. But thank you very much. That a bit abrupt?
So are we done?
Are we done?
Are we done?
Maybe we should, yeah, I think so. All right. Are we done for today? I think we're done. I think we've said enough for today. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Show notes, packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter, packetpushers. Good to talk to you, Matt.
Yeah, the same, my friend.
We should catch do it again, do it more often. But we say that every time, never do.
See you later.